Professor Buzz Sure dives into originalism in the Supreme Court of the United States. This is The Legal Impact, presented by the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law. Now accepting applications for JD, graduate programs, and online professional certificates. Learn more and apply at law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, this is a subject we loosely touched upon in a previous episode around transgender and gay worker protection. But with Judge Amy Coney Barrett hearings going on, it seems like the perfect time to dive into the subject. To start off with, how would you define the term originalism?
Originalism treats the Constitution like a statute. Judges are like a law, and they read the statute, the law, the provision of the Constitution, and give it the meaning that the words were understood to have at the time they were written. That's originalism, as distinguished from another theory of constitutional interpretation called textualism, where that is a means which originally came out of reading statutes, but that's a means of reading the constitutional provision to take the objective meaning of the words, regardless of what was intended by those who wrote it, whenever they wrote it. So those are sometimes overlapping, but most often separate theories of constitutional interpretation, but only two of many. Amy Coney Barrett views herself as a devotee of originalism. Her mentor, she clerked for Justice Anton Scalia. He was her mentor before he died, and he was the most prominent originalist that's been on the Supreme Court.
In this context, is there a difference between, you kind of hinted on this, but there's a difference between the way with this concept where you interpret the Constitution and laws that are created by Congress when it comes to how you would think about.
An originalist, you would think about if it's a part of the Constitution, what the people who wrote that provision in the Constitution were thinking about when they wrote that law. It's just when you are talking about a law passed by Congress, you're going to think about what was the intent of the writers of the law. Originalism, you can apply originalism to a statute passed by Congress just as well as you can apply it to a constitutional provision. I'm not a big advocate of using only originalism to interpret the Constitution. I think it's a sole method of interpreting the Constitution, it's a bad method. It treats the Constitution like just another statute, where statutes are specific provisions, more specific provisions written to deal with a more specific proposition. Whereas the Constitution, in my thinking, is a set of broad principles that lay the foundation for statutes, court decisions, people's behavior. And I think to analogize, to make equivalent provision in the Constitution to it's just another law is a huge mistake, and it really does a disservice to the importance of the Constitution. I think the people who wrote the Constitution were very conscious of writing down a set of principles with which a government could be established. They were not they did not intend to write statutes to cover every situation they can anticipate coming up with that might come up in the future. And that's the job of statutes. It's kind of the grunt work that statutes do, the grunt work of implementing principles. You can't pass a statute that violates constitutional principle. but the country could not operate if we just had the Constitution and no laws. Right? Yeah. There's not enough substance in the Constitution by design to run a country or run a state or run a city. It's by design. It's just an overarching set of principles. So I think it's deeply mistaken to solely rely on originalism as a way of interpreting the Constitution.
I'm assuming people that believe more in the originalist interpretation would expect the amendments to the Constitution to do what you're saying would be done via interpretation.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this.
The amendments to the Constitution... Yeah, the amendments to the Constitution are same as the Constitution. They are the Constitution. They just came a little bit later, some of them a lot later, some of them, just a little bit later. But there's no difference between the amendments, the Bill of Rights, and anything else in the Constitution in terms of their acting as principles. In fact, the Bill of Rights articulate even less than the rest of the Constitution. The rest of the Constitution sets up at least some hard and fast structural provisions. We're going to have a Congress. We're going to have a presidency. We're going to have a judiciary. Whereas the Bill of Rights are just pure principle. You have the right to confront a witness against you. That's the Confrontation Clause. The Equal Protection Clause. Everybody's got to be treated equally. It's a principle. The government shall not engage in unreasonable searches and seizures. That's a principle. It doesn't solve the problem in every case, particularly because when that principle was written, we didn't have organized police forces. We had town by town constables. So, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have health data. We didn't have genetic information. So it's really difficult if you treat the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment, as a law and not a principle. You really do a disservice to what the framers intended. That said, and here's an important point, I think it's useful to look at what the framers intended in deciding how to apply the Fourth Amendment in a particular case, or the Confrontation Clause in a particular place, or the Equal Protection Clause in a particular place. It's useful just as textual analysis. What are the objective meaning of the words is useful, as is, what are our current societal values? If we ignore current societal values, then black people were only worth 3/5 of a person under the Constitution. Women couldn't vote. The only people who could vote were white men of property, effectively. So it really. It's valuable. Looking at what they intended by what they wrote is one valuable tool in interpreting what the principle means. Looking at the actual words, regardless of the intent of the writers of the Fourth Amendment, is valuable. And what are the objective meaning of the words? But what is unreasonable in terms of searching people's information in their cell phone? Is that an unreasonable search for the police to go in there without getting a search warrant? What the framers intended, if you think of the Fourth Amendment as a law, what the framers intended by the law is totally useless in figuring out how that principle applies to a cell phone. are almost completely useless. We need, you know, they wrote the Constitution appreciating that the world was going to change and it wasn't going to be static. And that's where you get another, what's sometimes called the living Constitution version of constitutional interpretation, where you put to, you know, you take all these things together. You take, what did they intend when they wrote it? You know, what is the objective meaning of those words? What are the set of values that is clear exist in society today about, you know, whether the information contained in our cell phone or the information contained in our DNA is private or not? So it's, you know, it's an ongoing debate. I think it's often misrepresented and thought about incorrectly with lay people who think, yeah, let's just use what the words say and we're fine. You know, we don't need to have judges interpreting things. Just use what the words say. Yeah. Well, when the government is permitted from engaging in unreasonable searches, yeah. So how do you deal with the word unreasonable? You know, if you apply the Equal Protection Clause literally, it means that 12-year-olds can get a private, you can't ban a 12-year-old from getting a license to fly a commercial airline, because you would be treating him differently than a 30-year-old with a, you know, license. That's what statutes are for.
Right. Yeah. And maybe this is a good way to look at it, too, is what are some Supreme Court cases where maybe a couple, one that goes specifically where the conservative, more originalist interpretation justices were across the board separate from the more living Constitution justices? And then also where maybe they were mixed between the conservative and liberal justices.
There's a great case about that. It's U.S. versus Jones. It's a perfect case for this discussion in terms of the facts of the case were the police suspected Jones, the D.C. police suspected Jones of being a major drug dealer in the area. And he transacted. They suspected that he transacted his business using his SUV. So they put a GPS on the bottom of his SUV. They didn't enter the car. They just put it on the bottom of the SUV when it was in a public garage. They didn't enter his property. And they followed him around for 10 days, accumulating all sorts of information about his whereabouts. And that allowed them to eventually get a search warrant and to arrest him. Perfect example of part of what I've already talked about, you know, no GPSs back in the 18th century. Is that an unreasonable search to follow somebody's whereabouts while they're in public in this sophisticated electronic way that allows you to gather a mass of information about their life over the course of 10 days just by where they go? Or is that the same thing as just a cop following him around in a car for 10 days? So it's an interesting question about, you know, broadly, the very relevant question, societal question today is, how much privacy do we maintain in public when we go out in public? Or are we fair game? Can the police put a GPS on the bottom of your car? Can they have cameras at every intersection and everywhere so they can follow you around wherever you go? Can they pick up your discarded coffee cup with your saliva on it and mine it for your DNA, your genetic information? You know, or do we still retain some privacy rights when we, some constitutional privacy rights when we go out in public? So it's a, you know, a real live issue today in the court system and in interpreting the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. In the opinion, the court ended up saying, yeah, they had a Fourth Amendment privacy interest in their whereabouts as accumulated over 10 days in that fashion. But there were five separate opinions
That's got to be kind of the problem with originalism, is it's you're trying to take context from things that happened, could have been hundreds of years ago at this point, and trying to put them into modern times where they might all come to the same conclusion that, yeah, this is what it means. But it's to get down in the weeds, it can get a little messy.
Well, yeah, exactly. And what one judge, the originalist in this circumstance, said this: back in the 18th century, it might well have been the case that counted as in some version of what would be called now criminal mischief. You caused some damage to the car by the SUV by placing the GPS on the bottom of the car. You know, that's what you run into with this originalist stuff. You run into these really tortured interpretations to maintain the integrity of your philosophical, your jurisprudential approach. And, you know, again, it's useful. Originalism is a useful tool, as is textualism, as is living constitution. The problem that people run into with the living constitution approach is it feels like partially correctly that you are having people who are not elected and are not subject to any election and who are lifetime appointments deciding policy issues. And yes, they are, but they're deciding policy issues within the limits of what the constitutional provision says. They can't make it come out however they want to. You know, they need to still retain the integrity of lending it meaning that makes sense in terms of all the factors they consider, what the founders were thinking about as to the principle, what, if not the words, what the founders were, what the words say objectively, regardless of what anyone intended. And then, you know, how we think about privacy in public today, as opposed to privacy in public in the 18th century. You know, I'm hard pressed to believe that any, even a very pure originalist, really think we should apply the same privacy laws that were in place, such as they were in the 18th century, or privacy jurisprudence that existed in English history, to our sense of privacy in this high-tech world. So it's, you know, that's why you have that tension between unelected people interpreting principles and putting too much of their policy in place without regard for the fundamental principle, versus people, you know, coming up with this really tortured analysis about criminal mischief and a GPS in the 18th century and a GPS on the bottom of a car. Yeah, therein is the essence of that tension between living constitution and originalism.
Can you speak to how this ended up so partisan when it comes to the more liberal justices not necessarily being on the originalist side of the House?
It's partisan because a political entity recommends appoints and another political entity gives their consent to the appointment of a justice. I mean, you know, a president is elected, and there are, you know, these different perspectives have historically been reflected, depending on the historical era, in political parties. You know, the idea of originalism, you know, there's this idea that runs throughout this originalism living constitution debate, another layer of it that talks about activist judges. You know, truth were to be told, you know, there's as many originalists who effectively are activist judges in depending on how you define activism, as there are living constitution judges who are activist judges. You know, depends on how you define activism. You know, is finding a statute unconstitutional activism? There's been more conservative majorities over the last 10 years in U.S. Supreme Court that have found statutes unconstitutional than there have been liberal majorities on the Supreme Court. So, you know, that idea of activist judges, which over the last 20 years, conservatives have run on as a bad thing, is really kind of a shell game. You know, you're an activist judge if you decide the case the way I don't want you to.
Yeah.
I want you to, depending on your beliefs, right?
Totally. I mean, it's probably also a bit of a thing with regards to justices having, it's a lifetime position. They can stand basically as long as they want, so long as they're not impeached. Where, like with Judge Amy Coney Barrett, she was a clerk under Antonin Scalia. She bought into the way he thought about the Constitution, and now we got the next justice coming in that's following that line of reasoning.
Yep. So there's that, you know, it's like there's that tree of acolytes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, and you definitely see that with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, with the way she thought about cases and things like that.
Very much so. It's fascinating because it's a different institution. It's not bad that they have lifetime appointments, except when all the wrong people are getting appointed. But, you know, as a structural matter, it's not bad given the other two institutions are profoundly political. And it's good to have an institution that is more insulated from politics and trying, sometimes well, sometimes not well, depending on your perspective, trying to apply a set of constitutional principles to a world that is profoundly different from when those principles were written. You know, it's better that we don't have every court case involving the application of a constitutional principle decided by judges who are up for election every 2 years. That would be a profound nightmare to have constitutional interpretation done that way.
Thanks for listening to The Legal Impact, presented by UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. To help spread word about the show, please be sure to subscribe and comment on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify.